Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a master's degree in English with a concentration in literature studies and an MFA in creative writing. strose.edu/gradprograms.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Malcolm Gladwell is the award-winning author of 5 New York Times bestsellers, including The Tipping Point, Blink, Outliers, and David and Goliath. While this is The Book Show, this installment could be called The Author Show, because we welcome Malcolm Gladwell to talk about his body of work and impact on our society. Gladwell was named one of the 100 most influential people by Time magazine and one of foreign policy's top global thinkers. He is a celebrated journalist, author, and speaker. He has been a staff writer for The New Yorker since 1996. Previously, he worked at The Washington Post. This edition of The Book Show is in partnership with Oblong Books and Music in Rhinebeck and Millerton, New York, and recorded before a live audience at the White Hart Inn in Salisbury, Connecticut. They will join me in welcoming Malcolm Gladwell to The Book Show. What does Gladwellian mean?
Oh, dear. I don't know. I object to that term, which I suspect was created by the public relations department of my publisher.
Little Brown.
Without my permission. Anytime someone tries to adjectivize your name, only bad things, I feel like, ensue. You hate to think you can be summed up.
Do you get what it means as far as, even as a marketing tool, of what it says to a public about what you do?
One of the things that's odd about writing books is that things that are obvious to your readers are not obvious to you. So, although I like to think I can see patterns in the world, usually fail to see patterns in myself. So I think of the books that I write as being wholly disconnected and that they bear no resemblance to each other. Others think of them as versions of the same idea over and over again. I suppose what people are saying when they use that word is that they see a kind of common thread and technique in the way that I write. But I am completely blind to that. I'm not terribly introspective, so that extends to my work as well as my personality.
Talk about that, about being introspective in your work. Do you find that it is an outside looking in, or do you bring yourself into the writing at all? I mean, besides the actual, you're writing it, so there's that part. But I mean yourself and an autobiographical quality to the background of what you're talking about.
If you do the kind of writing that I do, it's dangerous to inject yourself too much into it. So, for example, this is a very, very prosaic example. Many New Yorker writers commonly use I in their stories. I never do, or at least haven't in at least 12 years. This last time, I think I last used I 12 years ago. I don't think you should use I, or at least I don't want to use I. I don't want to be front and center, and I don't want readers to think that what I'm writing about is something that is purely idiosyncratic. I want people to consider the subject that I'm writing about without having to kind of enter it through me. I tend to think that I'm not nearly as interesting as most of the people that I write about, and so why would I insert myself into the process? If I were to sit down and, here's an extreme example, and interview President Obama for 2 hours, why on earth would you be interested in me if you have a chance to learn about Obama? Long after I have been forgotten by history, people will be reading long books and things on the President of the United States. So I just think there's an element of journalistic ego which is probably more usefully suppressed.
I understand that, and I applaud that. However, using that example, you have two men of biracial background who were at the pinnacle of their respective professions. Is there something to be gained for us mm-hmm. as an audience to have the two of you discuss that?
Interesting. My instinct would be to say no, but maybe for a little bit. I mean, if I had Obama for 2 hours, would it be useful to discuss our common biracial heritage for 5 minutes? Yes. But for any longer than that, probably not. We have very different... Here's a little fun thing that only people who are biracial ever think about, which is there's two kinds of biracial marriages. There's the traditional kind and there's the modern kind. The traditional biracial marriage is where the father is white and the mother is black. That's the 17th, 18th century marriage. When you had biracial marriages in the time of slavery, that's what it was. White landowner, black woman. Only in the 60s did that start to reverse, where you would have black father, white mother. So Obama comes from a contemporary biracial marriage, a very modern kind. I come from the traditional kind. Mm. And I sort of think, now I'm talking myself into this thing that you suggested I do with President Obama. It would be really interesting, wouldn't it, to discuss with him the differences in the dynamic of our parents. Now, of course, it's hard in his case because his parents weren't really together much,
right.
Whereas mine are still together. So it's a very different kind of thing. But I would be curious for him to muse on that. It's a very different experience, perhaps, if you think about race in America, if you're to have a black father as opposed to a white father.
When you write a book like David and Goliath, do you think about how you first heard of that story, what you knew of that story? And that's part of it. You just don't let the reader in on that.
Yes. So was I drawn to the story of David and Goliath for personal reasons? Absolutely. My mother used to read the Bible to me as a child. And there were a series of stories that I spent an enormous amount of time thinking about as a kid. The story of David and Goliath is one. The one I actually was obsessed with as a child was Daniel in the Lion's Den. And I would make my mother read it to me over and over again. What's so fantastic about the story of David and Goliath, as is the case with so many biblical stories, is that they are infinitely more complex than they appear to be at first blush, right? That is why the Bible continues to be this extraordinarily enduring document, because it continues to yield insights. We're a couple thousand years in, and it's still proving to be a source of wonderment and mystery, and which is pretty incredible, right? I mean, I don't expect my books to have a lifespan of more than about 5 years. Part of what was so thrilling about writing that book was that opening kind of reinterpretation of the story. I mean, who would have thought that after all this time, there is a brand new interpretation of David and Goliath out there for the taking? I thought that was kind of fantastic.
Do you find that, though, with most subjects? I mean, you most recently wrote an incredible article about school shootings.
Yeah.
That you managed to have something new to say about that.
Well, there is always something new to say about almost everything. That's what I consider to be the foundational principle of journalism. And when you, as a journalist, your first instinct when you start is to believe that there are a finite number of stories out there. One of the really amusing things to me, and I remember when I was this way myself, meeting young journalists, is how zealously they guard their ideas because they think there's a limited number. So they won't tell you what they're working on because they're afraid you'll steal it. But after a while, in journalism, you realize, first of all, that no one's going to steal your idea. But even if they do, there's a million other ideas out there. Right? You can't proceed as a journalist on the assumption that there's only six ideas, and so you must zealously guard them. Right? So if you figure out journalism, the thing that begins that process of figuring out is the understanding that there are an infinite number of interesting things to say about the world.
In that particular subject, school shootings, you bring in history, you bring in sociology, you bring in psychology, a lot of research. What did you find there that got you thinking?
There's a sociologist named Mark Granovetter, who I love and whose work I've read for years, who wrote a series of papers over the course of his career, each of which you could spend your lifetime thinking about. He had written a paper about riots in 1973, which I read years ago, and it has always stuck with me. It's such a kind of simple and pure and elegant way of describing why ordinary people will sometimes engage in pathological behavior. And I've always wanted to write something based on that, his idea of riots. And so this summer, I thought, well, maybe school shootings is a good way to write about Mark Granovetter. And so I started doing this piece, and I wrote it around online and stumbled across this extraordinary thing that it seemed to me almost no one had written about, which was a 3-hour transcript of a police interview with a 17-year-old kid in Minnesota who had been caught accidentally just as he was planning the biggest school shooting in the history of American school shootings. And it's just sitting there online, this transcript. It's like 70 pages, and it's extraordinary. I mean, you could publish it, the transcript, as is. I mean, it's the kid is really articulate, intelligent, has thought about the whole thing, and talks about it in a way that chills you to the bone. So I just saw that, and it's like, this is extraordinary. We've never had access in such a kind of particular, intimate way to the inner thoughts of someone who is contemplating such an act. So most of the kids who do school shootings, they either die in the attempt, or afterwards we discover they are so damaged that they have nothing useful to tell us except to give us evidence of their pathology, of their distress and their hopelessly psychologically screwed up nature, right? It's not to learn that a kid was traumatized as a child and hears voices. It doesn't advance our understanding of why those conditions lead you to gun down all of your peers at school. But here you had a kid who wasn't nearly as damaged in that way and who laid it out sort of in chapter and verse. And it was just one of the most sobering, saddening, distressing things I've ever read. But I felt it gave us a kind of window into this really, I mean, think about it. It is now a commonplace, relatively commonplace act in the United States, almost alone among countries in the world, for teenagers to arm themselves, go to their high schools, and try and kill as many of their peers as possible. That's just like so bizarre and screwed up. One of the most screwed up and bizarre things about that phenomenon is it has been going on for so long that we almost take it for granted now. I mean, most of the times this happens, the incidents aren't even reported in the national media anymore. We treat it like we treat car accidents.
147 school shootings from Sandy Hook to the most recent shooting in Oregon. You talk in the article about how lots of boys are fascinated with guns, and they used to have outlets, and that those outlets have now vanished, and this has become the outlet, and that it also self-perpetuates because so often these kids are referencing other school shooters.
I mean, Columbine is the striking thing is how many of the shooters post-Columbine have very explicitly modeled their attacks on what happened, basically on Eric Harris.
Right.
Eric Harris is the kind of prophet of this movement. If I might use that word, it's not the right word, but it's become this highly ritualized, contagious phenomenon. And until you come to grips with its cultural dimensions, you can't understand it. One of my objections to the way that liberals, and I count myself as a liberal, discuss school shootings is they want to simplify it to a simple matter of the availability of guns. And that is undoubtedly a huge part of it, but that is by no means the whole story. And you could implement every gun control measure on the liberal agenda and still have school shootings. It is a phenomenon that feeds on the pervasiveness of guns in our environment, in our country, but it goes beyond that. It's much deeper and pervasive and scary than simply, you know, we had tons of guns in this country and no school shootings for an awful long time. So, you know, your work's not done just by removing guns. You have to address the fact that teenage boys have a very specific fantasy about using, and by the way, a lot of these boys don't even want to, I mean, guns are only the half of it. It's bombs that are really,
right.
I mean, we forget Columbine was a bombing, not a shooting, but the bombs didn't go off. So it became a shooting, but it was never planned as such. And the one I wrote about was a really just a bombing. He was going to take guns to the attack, but he was planning to blow the school up. When the fantasy is about bombs, you know, gun control doesn't even touch it. I almost feel like there's something about treating this as a gun control problem that evades the hard questions, which is, why do kids have these fantasies? And, you know, to you, you made that point about, I do feel, I didn't go into this a lot into the article, but I do feel it's the nub of it, which is, you have to give teenage boys with these kinds of interests less harmful avenues for their pathological fantasies. I read this fascinating thing about each of the four founders of PayPal as kids made bombs. They liked to tinker with their chemistry sets and blow things up. That's what kids have done, boys largely, for a long, long time. They've blown things up in their basement. And they've, like I said in the piece, have dreamt of being astronauts. Now they blow things up in their basement, only they dream of being school shooters. Somehow a kind of benign fantasy got redirected in a terrifying direction. And that's the core of it. I don't know what happened in our culture that everything became raised to such high stakes. When I was a kid, I played obsessively with guns for a good 5 years, to the point where my mother thought of sending me to a therapist to talk about it. That's how I just played with guns nonstop. Now, as it turns out, as an adult, I am the most peaceful anti-violent. You know, I mean, I have no interest in guns whatsoever. I don't think about them, talk about them. I don't like violent things. I don't read violent books. I don't go to the movies at all. I mean, no one is less, but I had a phase. Then it went away. Turns out I'm not into guns. But you can imagine poor, you know, pacifistic Joyce Gladwell in rural Canada watching her son, you know, pretend that he's gunning down people with a machine gun. I mean, it must have been quite horrifying. But, you know, it got redirected. And that's the thing that we have to kind of figure out is, how can we safely redirect these very normal, common fantasies?
And how do we as a society figure out how to deal with a young man going into a kindergarten and killing 4, 5, and 6-year-old children?
You know, that's the thing. So Adam Lanza was completely immersed in the culture of school shooters. I mean, he had a spreadsheet, for goodness sake, where he had listed all the previous school shooters and how many victims they had, how many people they had killed. And he was sort of measuring himself up against that. And he was someone with a whole lot of psychological problems, all of which became narrowly focused on this specific question, this specific fantasy. It's not for nothing that the end of my New Yorker article offers zero solutions. I don't have a solution other than move back to Canada.
When you are writing, do you want to come to conclusions and solutions?
Where there is one, sometimes, but I don't really feel like my job is to solve problems. Books of the sort that I write are really ways of starting conversations or helping people think about the problems they have. But I don't think I can presume, if you think of yourself as a problem solver, you have an awful lot more self-confidence and ego than I do. I don't presume to be able to solve lots of things. That's awfully ambitious.
But are the answers to be found in investigative reporting that you do?
Well, I feel we can ask better questions if we know a little bit about what the landscape of social science looks like. And I feel like there's a lot to be gained by providing people with ways of understanding their experience. So a lot of my books are about giving people theories, ways of organizing their world. Or, you know, because I feel, I've often said, we are experience rich and theory poor. Most of us have tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of case studies and examples in our life of things, but limited time to arrange them and make sense of them. A journalist's job is to do that arranging for people, to allow them to see patterns in things that would otherwise be obscure. And that's an important job. But I think when try and set themselves up as kind of gurus who can present these master plans for a better life, that strikes me as being awfully ambitious.
This may be an overly simplistic question, but do you always go into a piece for the New Yorker or an article that this is going to be an article and this is going to be a book? Are those separate pursuits?
No, they're all part of the same thing. They all lead in the same direction. So every time you write something, I feel like it plants a series of seeds in your brain. Like I just read this book that I'm going to review for the New Yorker, which is this memoir by the guy who used to head the National Cancer Institute. The book is like the most kind of blunt, opinionated, unbelievably engaging account of how medicine works that I've ever read. It's so different from anything else I've ever read in medicine. I'm still like reeling from it. And I don't know, I'm sure it'll lead me in 10 different directions. I read a chapter on a train coming up here and just spent the rest of the time just thinking about the chapter. It was just so kind of like, he has this vision of, this guy, his name is Vince DeVita, and the book's called The Death of Cancer. And at a time when all of our discussion about medicine and cancer has become incredibly kind of formalized, he goes back and says, it's about personalities and people. It's like a kind of discussion about medicine that I haven't read in 25 years. And he walks you through all these case studies of examples where somebody has come up with a way better way of treating a specific kind of cancer, and the rest of the medical profession takes forever to accept it.
Mm.
And it's so sobering, because you realize oncologists are incredibly well-educated, intelligent people. I believe that 99% of them are motivated by one thing and one thing only, and that is making their patients better. If they were trying to make money, they wouldn't have become doctors, right? There were plenty of options these people had if they wanted to make money. Going to medical school for 6 years and then doing another 6 years of medical training is not the thing that you do if you're trying to get rich, right? So let's just put that aside. But even then, it's incredibly hard for people to accept new ideas, to embrace innovation, to decide at the age of 45, when they've spent their entire career doing something a certain way, that it's time to change, radically adopt a new... And it's just like understanding how hard that is and how the job in... If you read this book, you understand the job of leaders in the world of medicine is, more than anything else, to convince their peers to embrace change as quickly as possible. That job is more important than whatever brilliant thing you discover in the laboratory, whatever, you know, direction they send health policy in, whatever. No, it's about going to so-and-so at such and such a place and holding his hand and saying, you know, you've got to change. This is better. And I'm going to sit here and, you know, look you in the eye and until you start treating patients in this new way. You know, he has this one section where he's the guy who, Vince DeVita is the guy who came up with, he's really the one who figured out how to successfully treat and cure Hodgkin's lymphoma. Mm. And the idea was you had to use combination chemotherapy, more than one drug in combination, in a very, very specific way, using a particular schedule at a particular dose. And you had to be ready to accept the fact that the minute you gave your patients the drugs, they were going to go down the hall to the bathroom and throw up for 8 hours. And if you couldn't handle that, then that's a problem, right? Because that was going to happen in 100% of the cases.
Mm.
And he would go around the country and people would say, I tried your new idea for Hodgkin's lymphoma and it doesn't work. And then he would say, okay, tell me exactly how you did it. And invariably they would have deviated from the exact instructions he'd given them. And he would say, why did you deviate? And they would give some excuse. He went to Sloan Kettering and they said the excuse they gave him was, well, our patients go home on the subway. We don't want them throwing up on the subway. And he was like, if the choice is between dying and throwing up on the subway, what, you know, like that was the kind of conversation he was having. It's been a long time since I had someone explain the job of a leader in a complex field in such a kind of blunt, simple, and sort of eye-opening way. Maybe what it takes to be a really good leader is a lot simpler than we imagine.
Malcolm Gladwell is the award-winning author of 5 New York Times bestsellers, including The Tipping Point, Blink, Outliers, and David and Goliath. Malcolm Gladwell, what a great thrill and honor to have you join us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. This edition of The Book Show is in partnership with Oblong Books and Music in Rhinebeck and Millerton, New York, oblongbooks.com. It was recorded before a live audience at the White Hart Inn in Salisbury, Connecticut. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.